Chapter 25. It was now the year of our Lord 1272, and Prince Edward, the heir to the throne, being away in the Holy Land, knew nothing of his father's death. The barons, however, proclaimed him king immediately after the royal funeral, and the people very willingly consented, since most men knew too well by this time what the horrors of a contest for the crown were. So King Edward I, called, in a not very complimentary manner, Longshanks, because of the slenderness of his legs, was peacefully accepted by the English nation. His legs had need to be strong, however long and thin they were, for they had to support him through many difficulties on the fiery sands of Asia, where his small force of soldiers fainted, died, deserted, and seemed to melt away. But his prowess made light of it, and he said, "I will go on, if I go on with no other follower than my groom." A prince of this spirit gave the Turks a deal of trouble. He stormed Nazareth, at which place, of all places on earth, I am sorry to relate, he made a frightful slaughter of innocent people, and then he went to Acre, where he got a truce of 10 years from the Sultan. He had very nearly lost his life in Acre, through the treachery of a Saracen noble, called the Emir of Jaffa, who, making the pretense that he had some idea of turning Christian, and wanted to know all about that religion, sent a trusty messenger to Edward very often with a dagger in his sleeve. At last, one Friday in Whitsun week, when it was very hot, and all the sandy prospect lay beneath the blazing sun, burned up like a great overdone biscuit, and Edward was lying on a couch, dressed for coolness in only a loose robe, the messenger, with his chocolate-colored face and his bright dark eyes and white teeth, came creeping in with a letter, and kneeled down like a tame tiger. But, the moment Edward stretched out his hand to take the letter, the tiger made a spring at his heart. He was quick, but Edward was quick too. He seized the traitor by his chocolate throat, threw him to the ground, and slew him with the very dagger he had drawn. The weapon had struck Edward in the arm, and although the wound itself was slight, it threatened to be mortal, for the blade of the dagger had been smeared with poison. Thanks, however, to a better surgeon than was often to be found in those times, and to some wholesome herbs, and above all, to his faithful wife, Eleanor, who devotedly nursed him, and is said by some to have sucked the poison from the wound with her own red lips, which I am very willing to believe, Edward soon recovered, and was sound again. As the king his father had sent entreaties to him to return home, he now began the journey. He had got as far as Italy, when he met messengers who brought him intelligence of the king's death. Hearing that all was quiet at home, he made no haste to return to his own dominions, but paid a visit to the Pope, and went in state through various Italian towns, where he was welcomed with acclamations as a mighty champion of the cross from the Holy Land, and where he received presents of purple mantles and prancing horses, and went along in great triumph. The shouting people little knew that he was the last English monarch who would ever embark in a crusade, or that within 20 years every conquest which the Christians had made in the Holy Land at the cost of so much blood would be won back by the Turks. But all this came to pass. There was, and there is, an old town standing in a plain in France, called C.H. Lons. When the king was coming towards this place on his way to England, a wily French lord, called the Count of C.H. Lons, sent him a polite challenge to come with his knights and hold a fair tournament with the count and his knights, and make a day of it with sword and lance. It was represented to the king that the Count of C.H. Lons was not to be trusted, and that, instead of a holiday fight for mere show and in good humor, he secretly meant a real battle, in which the English should be defeated by superior force. The king, however, nothing afraid, went to the appointed place on the appointed day with 1,000 followers. When the count came with 2,000, and attacked the English in earnest, the English rushed at them with such valor, that the count's men and the count's horses soon began to be tumbled down all over the field. The count himself seized the king round the neck, but the king tumbled him out of his saddle in return for the compliment, and, jumping from his own horse, and standing over him, beat away at his iron armor like a blacksmith hammering on his anvil. Even when the count owned himself defeated, and offered his sword, the king would not do him the honor to take it, but made him yield it up to a common soldier. There had been such fury shown in this fight, that it was afterwards called the Little Battle of Ch. Lons. The English were very well disposed to be proud of their king after these adventures. So, when he landed at Dover in the year 1274, being then 36 years old, and went on to Westminster, where he and his good queen were crowned with great magnificence, splendid rejoicings took place. For the coronation feast there were provided, among other eatables, 400 oxen, 400 sheep, 450 pigs, 18 wild boars, 300 flitches of bacon, and 20,000 fowls. The fountains and conduits in the street flowed with red and white wine instead of water. The rich citizens hung silks and cloths of the brightest colors out of their windows, to increase the beauty of the show, and threw out gold and silver by whole handfuls, to make scrambles for the crowd. In short, there was such eating and drinking, such music and capering, such a ringing of bells and tossing of caps, such a shouting, and singing, and reveling, as the narrow overhanging streets of old London City had not witnessed for many a long day. All the people were merry except the poor Jews, who, trembling within their houses, and scarcely daring to peep out, began to foresee that they would have to find the money for this joviality sooner or later. To dismiss this sad subject of the Jews for the present, I am sorry to add that in this reign they were most unmercifully pillaged. They were hanged in great numbers, on accusations of having clipped the king's coin, which all kinds of people had done. They were heavily taxed. They were disgracefully batched. They were, on one day, 13 years after the coronation, taken up with their wives and children, and thrown into beastly prisons, until they purchased their release, by paying to the king £12,000. Finally, every kind of property belonging to them was seized by the king, except so little as would defray the charge of their taking themselves away into foreign countries. Many years elapsed before the hope of gain induced any of their race to return to England, where they had been treated so heartlessly, and had suffered so much. If King Edward I had been as bad a king to Christians as he was to Jews, he would have been bad indeed. But he was, in general, a wise and great monarch, under whom the country much improved. He had no love for the Great Charter few kings had, through many, many years, but he had high qualities. The first bold object which he conceived when he came home was to unite under one sovereign England, Scotland, and Wales, the two last of which countries had each a little king of its own, about whom the people were always quarreling and fighting, and making a prodigious disturbance a great deal more than he was worth. In the course of King Edward's reign he was engaged, besides, in a war with France. To make these quarrels clear, we will separate their histories, and take them thus. Wales, first. France, second. Scotland, third. Llewellyn was the Prince of Wales. He had been on the side of the barons, in the reign of the stupid old king, but had afterwards sworn allegiance to him. When King Edward came to the throne, Llewellyn was required to swear allegiance to him also, which he refused to do. The king, being crowned and in his own dominions, three times more required Llewellyn to come and do homage, and three times more Llewellyn said he would rather not. He was going to be married to Eleanor de Montfort, a young lady of the family, mentioned in the last reign, and it chanced that this young lady, coming from France with her youngest brother, Emeric, was taken by an English ship, and was ordered by the English king to be detained. Upon this, the quarrel came to a head. The king went, with his fleet, to the coast of Wales, where, so encompassing Llewellyn, that he could only take refuge in the bleak mountain region of Snowdon in which no provisions could reach him, he was soon starved into an apology, and into a treaty of peace, and into paying the expenses of the war. The king, however, forgave him some of the hardest conditions of the treaty, and consented to his marriage. And he now thought he had reduced Wales to obedience. But the Welsh, although they were naturally a gentle, quiet, pleasant people, who liked to receive strangers in their cottages among the mountains, and to set before them with free hospitality whatever they had to eat and drink, and to play to them on their harps, and sing their native ballads to them, were a people of great spirit when their blood was up. Englishmen, after this affair, began to be insolent in Wales, and to assume the air of masters, and the Welsh pride could not bear it. Moreover, they believed in that unlucky old Merlin, some of whose unlucky old prophecies somebody always seemed doomed to remember when there was a chance of its doing harm. And just at this time some blind old gentleman with a harp and a long white beard, who was an excellent person, but had become of an unknown age and tedious, burst out with a declaration that Merlin had predicted that, when English money had become round, a Prince of Wales would be crowned in London. Now, King Edward had recently forbidden the English penny to be cut into halves and quarters for halfpence and farthings, and had actually introduced a round coin. Therefore, the Welsh people said this was the time Merlin meant, and rose accordingly. King Edward had bought over Prince David, Llewellyn's brother, by heaping favors upon him, but he was the first to revolt, being perhaps troubled in his conscience. One stormy night, he surprised the castle of Arden, in possession of which an English nobleman had been left, killed the whole garrison, and carried off the nobleman a prisoner to Snowdon. Upon this, the Welsh people rose like one man. King Edward, with his army, marching from Worcester to the Menai Strait, crossed it near to where the wonderful tubular iron bridge now, in days so different, makes a passage for railway trains by a bridge of boats that enabled 40 men to march abreast. He subdued the island of Anglesea, and sent his men forward to observe the enemy. The sudden appearance of the Welsh created a panic among them, and they fell back to the bridge. The tide had in the meantime risen, and separated the boats. The Welsh pursuing them, they were driven into the sea, and there they sunk, in their heavy iron armor, by thousands. After this victory Llewellyn, helped by the severe winter weather of Wales, gained another battle, but the king ordering a portion of his English army to advance through South Wales, and catch him between two foes, and Llewellyn bravely turning to meet this new enemy, he was surprised and killed very meanly, for he was unarmed and defenseless. His head was struck off and sent to London, where it was fixed upon the tower, encircled with a wreath, some say of ivy, some say of willow, some say of silver, to make it look like a ghastly coin in ridicule of the prediction. David, however, still held out for 6 months, though eagerly sought after by the king, and hunted by his own countrymen. One of them finally betrayed him with his wife and children. He was sentenced to be hanged, drawn, and quartered, and from that time this became the established punishment of traitors in England, a punishment wholly without excuse, as being revolting, vile, and cruel, after its object is dead, and which has no sense in it, as its only real degradation, and that nothing can blot out, is to the country that permits on any consideration such abominable barbarity. Wales was now subdued. The queen giving birth to a young prince in the castle of Carnarvon, the king showed him to the Welsh people as their countryman, and called him Prince of Wales. a title that has ever since been borne by the heir apparent to the English throne, which that little prince soon became, by the death of his elder brother. The king did better things for the Welsh than that, by improving their laws and encouraging their trade. Disturbances still took place, chiefly occasioned by the avarice and pride of the English lords, on whom Welsh lands and castles had been bestowed. But they were subdued, and the country never rose again. There is a legend that to prevent the people from being incited to rebellion by the songs of their bards and harpers, Edward had them all put to death. Some of them may have fallen among other men who held out against the king, but this general slaughter is, I think, a fancy of the harpers themselves, who, I dare say, made a song about it many years afterwards, and sang it by the Welsh firesides until it came to be believed. The foreign war of the reign of Edward I arose in this way. The crews of two vessels, one a Norman ship, and the other an English ship, happened to go to the same place in their boats, to fill their casks with fresh water. Being rough, angry fellows, they began to quarrel, and then to fight the English with their fists, the Normans with their knives, and, in the fight, a Norman was killed. The Norman crew, instead of revenging themselves upon those English sailors with whom they had quarreled who were too strong for them, I suspect, took to their ship again in a great rage, attacked the first English ship they met, laid hold of an unoffending merchant who happened to be on board, and brutally hanged him in the rigging of their own vessel with a dog at his feet. This so enraged the English sailors that there was no restraining them. And whenever, and wherever, English sailors met Norman sailors, they fell upon each other tooth and nail. The Irish and Dutch sailors took part with the English, the French and Genoese sailors helped the Normans, and thus the greater part of the mariners sailing over the sea became, in their way, as violent and raging as the sea itself when it is disturbed. King Edward's fame had been so high abroad, that he had been chosen to decide a difference between France and another foreign power, and had lived upon the continent 3 years. At first, neither he nor the French King Philip the Good Louis had been dead some time, interfered in these quarrels. But when a fleet of 80 English ships engaged, and utterly defeated a Norman fleet of 200, in a pitched battle fought round a ship at anchor, in which no quarter was given, the matter became too serious to be passed over. King Edward, as Duke of Guienne, was summoned to present himself before the King of France, at Paris, and answer for the damage done by his sailor subjects. At first, he sent the Bishop of London as his representative, and then his brother Edmund, who was married to the French Queen's mother. I am afraid Edmund was an easy man, and allowed himself to be talked over by his charming relations, the French court ladies. At all events, he was induced to give up his brother's dukedom for 40 days as a mere form, the French king said, to satisfy his honor, and he was so very much astonished, when the time was out, to find that the French king had no idea of giving it up again, that I should not wonder if it hastened his death, which soon took place. King Edward was a king, to win his foreign dukedom back again, if it could be won by energy and valor. He raised a large army, renounced his allegiance as Duke of Guienne, and crossed the sea, to carry war into France. Before any important battle was fought, however, a truce was agreed upon for 2 years, and in the course of that time, the Pope effected a reconciliation. King Edward, who was now a widower, having lost his affectionate and good wife, Eleanor, married the French king's sister, Margaret, and the Prince of Wales was contracted to the French king's daughter Isabella. Out of bad things, good things sometimes arise. Out of this hanging of the innocent merchant, and the bloodshed, and strife it caused, there came to be established one of the greatest powers that the English people now possess. The preparations for the war being very expensive, and King Edward greatly wanting money, and being very arbitrary in his ways of raising it, some of the barons began firmly to oppose him. Two of them, in particular, Humphrey Bohun, Earl of Hereford, and Roger Bigod, Earl of Norfolk, were so stout against him that they maintained he had no right to command them to head his forces in Guyenne, and flatly refused to go there. "By heaven, Sir Earl," apostrophe said the king to the Earl of Hereford, "in a great passion, you shall either go or be hanged." Apostrophe apostrophe "by heaven, Sir King," apostrophe replied the Earl, "I will neither go, nor yet will I be hanged." Apostrophe apostrophe and both he and the other Earl sturdily left the court, attended by many lords. The king tried every means of raising. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.